Commons Conversations is a series of interviews in which campaigners share their experiences and insights into activism, learning in movements, and radical history. Produced by the Commons Social Change Library, episodes in the fourth series cover multicultural and First Nations voices from the climate movement, regional and rural organising, artivism, fierce vulnerability and radical resilience, the fight against corporate disinformation, campaigns countering the far right, and more. The 2025 to 2026 series can be heard on Saturday afternoons between 1 and 2 p.m. in December and January on 3CR, or found as a podcast at 3cr.org.au/actingup or via commonslibrary.org. Welcome to Commons Conversations. This week's episode features a conversation between Neha Martok and Michelle Prasad, who recently engaged in research concerning the experiences of people of colour, First Nations people, and multicultural communities in the climate movement. Neha, who is the co-founder of Democracy in Colour, produced the Betraying White Supremacy report. Michelle, a Movement Monitor Fellow, produced First Nations and Multicultural Voices from the Climate Movement. Drawing on their reports, as well as their lived experience, Neha and Michelle identify systemic barriers to full participation and leadership, as well as the means by which a climate justice movement rooted in equity and self-determination can be created.
Well, I'm Neha. I've got about a decade of experience in the social justice sector. I've worked in unions, I've worked in nonprofits, and I guess most recently I helped to co-found an organization called Democracy in Colour, which is led by and for people of colour. And I was leading that for about 7 years. And alongside that as well, a big catalyst for starting Democracy in Colour was actually the experience that I and several other organizers and campaigners had in the climate space. And actually, we started out, many of us, as climate campaigners and organizers in the climate world, but we'd actually experienced so much racism that we found it really hard to keep working in that space. And we thought, well, let's create our own anti-racism organization to actually address these issues. And that then led to this report that I wrote for the Sunrise Project called Betraying White Supremacy. And it explores the experiences of people of colour, primarily people of colour, and a little bit the experiences of First Nations people as well, in the climate sector, both as volunteers and as staff members. We had people from youth organisations, really large NGOs, and also quite small NGOs that, you know, that all operate at different budgets and different theories of change and different styles. So we really wanted to cover the breadth and depth of the climate movement in this research. And the results are confronting, a little damning, but really, really keen to get into that discussion with you, Michelle.
Thanks, Neha. I am Michelle. I studied environmental management and kind of specialized in climate change and like when studying, but also when getting out into like working and stuff, I noticed like this massive gap between the social sciences and environmental science, and it just never made sense to me. And there was just such a big gap between the two, and you could see how that kind of translated into projects. So there was a kind of desire for me to kind of maybe enter the climate change movement with an understanding that there are very different perspectives, different cultural perspectives, and that that is such an integral part of understanding climate change. So I have been working for registered Aboriginal parties. I've also worked for SEED, Indigenous Youth Climate Network. I now work in on a research project in family violence, looking at like service delivery. So not currently in the climate change space, but still super passionate about it outside of work. I interviewed two First Nations activists and two called activists who are involved in the climate movement in Australia. The aim was to understand what the climate movement means to each activist and what it might mean for their community if there was greater visibility and inclusivity of their perspectives and their community's perspectives. We chatted a lot about the barriers people face in having their voice heard. What I heard across the board was First Nations and called communities bring so much knowledge and lived experience and are already doing so much place-based work, but there's just systemic barriers getting in the way, exclusionary practices, and because of this kind of rigid understanding of climate that's really kind of grounded in Western understandings of the environment, it really hinders their full participation in the movement. And what came out of those discussions was like some really tangible solutions for better bridging that gap and making it more of an inclusive movement.
So, Michelle, you had in-depth interviews with four climate activists to draw out insights. Can you share some of the findings related to inclusion and exclusion in the climate movement?
Yeah, thanks. So some of the findings related to inclusion and exclusion in the climate movement were that, as I touched on before, the climate movement is predominantly a white movement, or that's the kind of dominant narrative. And therefore, activists do feel that exclusion is widespread with little to no signs of improvement. Something I forgot to mention earlier was that these were de-identified kind of case studies that I did. So I'm going to use names that aren't the names of the real people that I interviewed. Some of the other things that came out from the interviewing activists were that the movement needs to recognize the importance of lived experience, community-led knowledge and leadership, and driving long-term change. In dominantly white climate spaces, leadership that understands the importance of diverse perspectives really supports inclusivity and like meaningful long-term impact. Across the board, it was felt that consultations are currently tokenistic, once-off, surface level. Some of the key things that just kind of stand out for me from those conversations were Lee had shared that, 90% of called people feel strongly about the climate movement but lack a pathway into the movement. I know that Kylie, a First Nations activist, had shared that there isn't enough representation on panels and where they're not getting invited, or they're getting invited last minute, attend different conferences and things. A lot of the kind of technical language and the climate messaging often alienates a lot of these communities. And some of the things that really stood out to me were the ignorance of local nuance when thinking about different communities, like someone had talked about the kind of Chinese and Indian community and that need for nuance when thinking about climate messaging and those kinds of things. We talked about the gas ban and how that can often evoke fears rooted in past experiences of losing access to reliable power or hot water. And that kind of nuance is really lost without that lived experience really guiding that. Yeah, those were some of the things that come to mind there. I know when I was talking to Priya, she was talking about organizing and this idea of organizing in the kind of rigidness in the way that maybe the climate movement views that, and that in her experience of working in the climate movement, there are so many communities doing place-based work already, and it's really about tapping into that existing work that's being done. And although it may not represent the exact top-down approach, there's so much value in that work. There were discussions around the kind of touching on the kind of rigidness of the climate movement. The First Nations activists particularly talked about the interconnectedness of climate change and climate justice. Things like, broader issues with over-incarceration, lack of access to clean water, education, housing insecurity, deforestation, like all these different elements really making up the climate movement, but they aren't often, climate change often isn't spoken about in that way. And we don't see programs that really respond to that multifaceted aspect of that. And I know Lee, who's a called activist, spoke about that messaging really needs to be multifaceted, particularly for migrant communities who are settling into a new country, educating their children, buying a home, things like that, have different kind of realities that we need to kind of consider when it comes to like approaching climate change messaging and inclusion within that space. And I know I'd mentioned earlier about inclusive leadership. I know Priya had shared example where she was able to cut back on technical explanations and encourage open discussions in small groups around understanding power bills and energy initiatives. And it was because, I mean, she had white leadership, but that she was willing to kind of give space to Priya and her lived experience to kind of pivot on that, which goes to show that leadership really does make a difference when it comes to the climate movement and the ability to be inclusive with that. There was a lot of other things discussed, but I think it's definitely worth reading the case studies because, yes, people had some really amazing things to say.
Definitely. I love reading case studies because you always get such a good insight into people's real experiences. And yeah, what you were saying really reminds me of some of what was brought up in the report that I wrote as well, Betraying White Supremacy, where people really talked about how in the climate world, if what you're talking about isn't specifically to do with emissions or stopping a coal mine or gas, then no one really wants to hear about it. And that, like, particularly for people of color, particularly for migrants, so many of us, our communities back home, our communities overseas, like communities that have been impacted by colonization, for instance, specifically like the South Asian community, like we have family all over the world because the British sent people all over the world. Like we know people in Kenya, we know people in England, we know people in the UK, in the US, and they're all related somehow. And so when climate change impacts them, for example, if someone's family are from Bangladesh and the Bangladeshi floods are happening, or Pakistan and the floods are happening, or, like my family, they're experiencing 50 degree days in India. That's climate change. It's here. It's happening. And when you come to work or you go to your climate volunteer group and people are talking about the impacts of climate change, you feel a bit nuts if people don't seem to even know what's happening in your home community, let alone understand it. And so people find that really alienating when they then go to be like, oh yeah, my nanny or my auntie is being impacted by these floods and here's how it's playing out. And people just can't even conceptualize it. And like climate is about people as much as it is about the planet, because like people, we come from the earth as well. We're part of this too. So often, especially in Australia, and white climate activists love to focus on nature and the environment as if it's this separate thing that we're not part of. But ask any First Nations climate activist and they will tell you that the connection to earth is why they are a climate activist. Connection to country is what drives them. And that for many of us, it is a feeling of responsibility actually to, protect this country that we're on and very lucky to be on. Or it is a connection as well to a homeland that you similarly want to protect because you want to protect the people, the community, the animals, like everything that is part of that, not just about stopping emissions. And I think like the response to Palestine, for instance, the October 7 attacks, I think really highlighted some of this, where a lot of people of color, First People, felt that pain and wanted to see the response to that pain amongst their community. Because like when you work in climate change, it's not just a day job that you rock up to 9 to 5. These are your comrades. These are the people that you are standing shoulder to shoulder with in the fight against extractive capitalism and extractive practices that have led us to this situation. And so you want to feel that solidarity because you're also doing that. You're showing up in solidarity with your mates, with your comrades. So you want to feel that back as well. And when you don't, it's really hurtful. And I think that was something that really came up in this research, the way that it's not just about even feeling left out or anything. It's actually just really hurtful. And think maybe even when we're able to think about it at that really human level, maybe that's a way that we can start to address it. But I think that's actually a really great segue. I'd love to ask you another question, which is that I found it really interesting how you described that connection between well-being and climate justice, where well-being has often been identified with individualistic self-care. But how do you see it differently for First Nations people and cold activists and communities?
Yeah, thanks so much, Neha, and totally agree with what you said there. It's a great segue into what was shared. It's interesting, but obviously no surprise. I think there was a lot that came out, particularly for First Nations activists around well-being and the kind of the overburdening aspect of just the bad news, the constant discrimination. I think Mia said this really well when she said it's emotionally, physically, spiritually exhausting. And a lot of that has to do with the kind of relentless bad news, from the destruction of sacred sites to staggering statistics of violence against her people. And then again, like kind of reflecting on what I shared earlier about that interconnectedness of climate justice and climate change with over-incarceration and housing and lack of access to education and food and all of those things. I think across the board, all the climate activists I spoke to felt burnt out. Really high workloads. A lot of this work often is driven by volunteers. People not getting paid a lot of work to do, this constant government not kind of believing that climate change even exists. I mean, when you're up against something like that, that is a lot to deal with. I think on top of that, particularly for First Nations activists, they talked a lot about the kind of cultural load, having kind of responsibilities outside of the climate work, although that isn't how they've kind of phrased it, but having families and having, other kind of considerations with the work, but being, often being approached by white orgs without that consideration of the kind of things that are going on for them outside of, needing to get a report back or whatever it is, and that lack of consideration or understanding for that adds to that load and that kind of burnout. Another thing I think was really interesting, Kylie had spoken about the funding landscape and that colonial capitalist approach to funding, where they're writing endless reports for scraps of funding, and there needs to be a rethink into the way that we do funding. Kylie talks about handing the money over. We know what's wrong. We know how to fix it. We can report back on how we've used that if that's necessary, but the way that it works and the kind of energy it takes to keep having to explain everything just to get scraps of funding or not to get any funding at all, it's just not a good system at all. Something else that First Nations activists talked about was the need for mob-only spaces and, allowing people to be able to kind of stop code switching and demask and consulting with First Nations people on what safe spaces look like. Because I think there is a feeling there that when you're walking into a white space, that you don't know what you're going to be walking into and how traumatizing it could be. And I think everyone expressed experiences of walking into rooms where they experience discrimination, their knowledge wasn't appreciated, or it's only appreciated in certain forms and not in others. I know that Priya, one of the called activists that I interviewed, talked about, this appreciation for Indian clothing, for example, and that being an appropriate expression of culture, but perhaps not, climate knowledge or lived experience related to community organizing or things like that. So yeah, a lot of that, yeah, kind of ties into the well-being aspect of things. And yeah, the workload, as I touched on, yeah, it's just a lot of different issues. But I think what is really important about the fact that this research was done, I think it's really important that people do read this and try to think about ways to lower that load for people doing this work, because they've identified some amazing solutions to bridging that gap for them, including reading resources before coming to people instead of asking basic questions about different things, and also being, sharing the load with First Nations activists, for example, and doing administrative work if they need it, because they are carrying such a big amounts of work already. So yeah, those were some of the things that came out of that.
Thanks for sharing that. I think what I'm really hearing as well is a lot of aspects of white supremacy culture. And that's also something that I looked at in my research. And I went back to the work that Tima Okun has done and would highly recommend anyone else look up their work as well. It's called White Supremacy Culture. It's a website very easily available online. But it's so clear how urgency, perfectionism, and individualism, which are three tenets of white supremacy culture, really play out in the climate movement. Like I was saying to someone just the other day, that it's not actually urgent unless there are a group of activists who are about to be run over by a bulldozer right now, who are, locked in on something. Or there is a really problematic bill that's come into parliament tomorrow. That's urgent. But made up urgency, we don't need to do that to ourselves. This is already very hard work. And so, how can we both be kind to ourselves, but also win? And I think that doing the two is really possible.
Yeah, amazing. So true. Very true. I know in your report you criticize the not-for-profit industrial complex, and you say the climate movement needs first people and communities of color much more than radicalized people need ENGOs. Can you talk more about that?
So what I really try and do in this report is give people a bit of a provocation. I'm assuming that the people reading this are probably white people in the climate movement, but also, anybody else as well in the climate movement. And what I really want them to do and think about is the fact that we are in the critical decade right now. We're in the critical decade for climate action. We know that whatever happens over the next 4 to 5 years is going to be so important for emissions and where our climate ends up in terms of warming. So when we look at this, and then we look at just the sheer amount of money that exists in the Australian climate space, let alone in the US and Europe, but just thinking about here, like compared to other nonprofits, compared to other social movements, thinking about, for instance, when I was running a racial justice organization, Democracy in Colour, there is no funding in Australia that is set aside for anti-racism work. Not a single foundation, not a single granting body has that money put aside for that work. Where it is put aside, it's for First People, and that is, of course, very appropriate. But there is this huge gap that exists in funding. And then you turn around and you look at the climate work and you go, why are there like 30 organizations who all seem to be doing the same thing, who all have budgets of $500,000 to $1 million minimum? Like, where is this money coming from? How is it possible that there are so many climate orgs who seem to be doing the same thing and all getting this funding? And then there is this critical work that also needs to happen with First People and people of color who are on the front lines of climate change right now, who are either experiencing climate change. I mean, take a look at the NT. The NT is projected to be uninhabitable within our lifetimes. And we know that, like, while the majority of Aboriginal people in Australia live in the major cities like Sydney, there are also massive remote community populations up in the NT, and they are experiencing climate change right now during the wet season. We're already seeing temperatures that are uninhabitable. So when I talk about the fact that the climate movement needs us more than we need them, it's because it's clear how we've been abandoned by the nonprofit industrial complex. Like, when there isn't funding put aside for us, that demonstrates that resourcing isn't considered important, or it possibly isn't even considered at all, right? Like, it's a potential oversight entirely. And that just demonstrates why we need to be in those spaces and why it's even more important to hand that cash over. Like I think it was Kylie in your report who was saying that, yeah, like, we can tell you what we've done with the money, but just hand it over and actually trust us to do the work. And I think people in my report were 100% saying the same thing. If we want to win, we need First People and people of color in our movements. Because think about it, we need to demonstrate to whether it is the Labor Party or the Liberal Party, whoever's in government, we need to demonstrate to them that the majority of Australia believes that we need action on climate change and we need it to be accelerated and far more aggressive than it is currently. And unless the Prime Minister is feeling that pressure from the community, why would they act? I mean, we would love them to act because they know it's the right thing to do, but unfortunately, this is politics and that's not how politics works. Politics works by building power and forcing our politicians to move with that power. And that power can come from money, it can come from the big mining magnates and the billionaires, or it can come from people power. And we have the ability to create people power. But you don't have people power if everyone in your movement is white and middle class and living in inner city Melbourne. That's not the majority of Australia. So you need to be able to demonstrate that people in Perth, in Brisbane, in Rockhampton, in Hobart, all think this is important, that they all are on board with this energy transition, and that they know that the government is going to make sure that that transition is fair as well. And I think all of those things are so critical. But unless we as a climate movement are talking about that fairness and how important it is that all Australians are part of this, how can we expect the Prime Minister, how can we expect the government to understand that if we're not able to understand that?
Yeah, wow, that is extremely true. I think that really ties into what I had heard also. It makes me think of what Lee said. I might have mentioned it earlier about voting also. And, you know, we've got diverse communities making up the voting pool. We do need everyone, kind of the more people on board as we can. Yeah, super interesting, Neha. Thanks for sharing that. I know that you also say that the state of Israel's genocidal attacks on Palestinians in Gaza have become a racial justice litmus test for climate movement organizations. What kind of responses have there been amongst organizations, and how has that impacted First Nations people and people of color in the movement?
Yeah, so what we saw after October 7, 2023 was almost radio silence, with the exception of a small number of organizations who were deeply connected to racial justice work, you know, organizations that were led by First People or that had an element of leadership by First People and people of color. They did respond, and they responded quickly and with a sense of urgency. What we also saw, though, was this paralysis amongst the movement, because there were people, when I was asking people, why aren't you saying something? Why aren't you doing something? We need more. And they were saying, I don't know. I'm worried about upsetting our funders. I'm worried about upsetting our supporters. I'm worried about the ACNC will come after us because this is quote unquote outside of our charitable purpose. And that really demonstrated to me again that this is something that kind of came as a surprise to a lot of white people. They were kind of like, oh, yeah, this horrible thing has happened and now we need to respond. And we haven't up until this point thought about how we will deal with our donors and how we will take our supporters on a journey. Like, we haven't thought about that. And to me, what I just see is this need for boards and for senior leadership to now at least go, okay, something like this is going to happen again. And we have supporters who are people of color, who are First People, who are affected by this, because Palestinians are First People. They're indigenous to the land. And there is a lot of global solidarity between First Nations people around the world with Palestinians. You know, there's this real sense of what happened in Palestine is just as much what happened in Australia. And that is why those communities feel such a connection to one another. And similarly for people of color, for those of us who come from backgrounds where we've experienced colonization, our families have experienced colonization, like the British colonizers only left, for my family's experience, they left India in 1947. And that kind of was the beginning of the fall of the true fall of the British Empire. My grandparents were alive then. My grandparents were working for the empire. You know, they were employed in this system. This is not something that happened a long time ago. This is living memory for many millions of people around the world. So when you think about that, and then you think about as well the fact that everybody gets up at all these climate things and says, oh, you know, I want to acknowledge the First People of this country that I'm on. And you go, okay, well, if you care so much about First Nations justice, you care, you're getting up here, you're making this land acknowledgement. That is important. But do you not understand what you're saying? Do you not understand what this land acknowledgement is? Because if you truly understood it, you would not question at any point solidarity with Palestine, because it is the same thing. You know, you've got this acknowledgement on your website. You start all of your meetings like this, but you're too scared to talk about Palestine. Like, I don't understand, because it's just the same thing. And if you're worried about your donors, well, isn't that a great provocation to go and start having conversations with donors about what redistributing their wealth looks like and what that means for them? And I think, having dealt with donors myself when I was a CEO of an organization, like, philanthropy is extremely white, and it is extremely not just white, but like white upper class, in a way where if you're not part of that, you feel like an outsider. And imagine being a like a First Nations person. Imagine being a person of colour from a working class background who's never met anyone who's got a net worth over $1 million before, let alone know what that really means, because tangibly, what does that mean to an everyday person? How to talk to them, and being told things like, oh no, you can't say that to the donor directly. You have to kind of hold their hand and do this circular thing and all of this stuff and deal with their white fragility. And I just found it exhausting. And so if there are white allies out there who are willing to do this kind of work with donors, I think that would be like a fantastic show of allyship, because it is so, so needed. You know, we need these donors to understand racial justice. We need them to get that they need to fund it. And what that looks like as well, it means handing over the money, recognizing that you might not understand how and why we spend the money. So for instance, at Democracy in Colour, the majority of our organizing budget went to food, venue hire and transport, because that was how we made our supporters, our community feel respected and heard. You know, you're going to come, you're going to do this community activism, and then we're going to have a really delicious feed and have joy together and get to know each other and build relationships. And then we're going to go away. But if you do that and you just go, oh, you know, I've clearly spent $5 at Coles on hummus and some carrot sticks, people aren't going to feel like you are investing in them. And so why would they invest in your organization? So I think what this is about is respect. It's about solidarity. And also it's quite simply about humanity. You know, like, this is just something horrific that's happening. And like, it almost got to a point where I was in this kind of dark humor of despair, saying to climate activists, you know that bombs emit emissions. You know that a lot of like trees and habitats and animals are also suffering because of what's happening. And I hate that I have to bring it down to such basic concepts for you. And it is so dehumanizing and horrible that you can't see that what's happening to Palestinians is bad. But when I explain to you how many emissions a bomb emits, that is what gets you over the line. Like, that's, you need to go away and do some self-reflection if that is you. But also, if that is the only thing that is convincing people, then that is just a clear demonstration of how dire things are.
Yeah, that feels super dystopian. It really makes me think about that kind of interconnected, holistic view of climate change that is very much missing from the movement. Yeah.
I was also just thinking that, like, we've spoken a lot about all the problems and all the issues, and I wonder if maybe we want to pivot over to what things that people can do, the tangible things that they can do and take away. Like, what do we think it will take to have a climate movement that is welcoming of First Nations people, people of colour, leadership, where people don't need to assimilate in order to be part of climate campaigns?
I want to start with just some things that come to mind, and they don't completely answer what you're saying, but I will, you know, circle back. And was reflecting on some of the things that people shared to me, the four activists that shared different things to me. And Mia had spoken about, who is a First Nations activist, talked about true climate justice isn't swapping fossil fuel billionaires for renewable energy billionaires. Yes. And I think that is something that we really need to think about. Also, you know, having public ownership of sustainable energy, meaningful consultation with First Nations communities at every stage of a project, redirecting public funds from fossil fuels into education, community resources, and preventing youth disengagement and incarceration. It's about healthcare, clean food, water, stable housing. I think something also that comes to mind is something that Kylie had said about, we know how we got here. So, you know, that's something that we actually have up our sleeves. We know how we got to this point. And so it is about kind of working together to repair, you know, the climate and not going back, but moving forward. And I think, yeah, and having Indigenous knowledge guide that. I know that Lee and Priya, who were the called activists that I spoke with, were talking about celebrating the kind of cultural resilience and the work already being done within called communities. A lot of us kind of came here with very little. So repurposing, recycling, they're already huge parts of what people are already doing. You had talked about earlier, you were talking about kind of food and the idea of kind of having the hummus and the carrots and what that kind of represented. I think what came to mind there was just how deeply like decolonial it is to kind of center food and sharing and how much we need that. It's very clear with the current dominant climate movement how much it is, kind of rooted in colonization and the deep need for decolonial practices at every kind of stage. Some other things that people had talked about were kind of funding volunteers who were doing a lot of the groundwork, compensating people, for their knowledge and their time, having them kind of be represented in panels and conversations, creating safe spaces, for First Nations people and for called people to be able to kind of find solidarity with each other. Because when you're, faced with such an exclusionary movement and have had past experience of feeling discrimination and exclusion, it's so critical that those safe spaces are set up, and they're not set up by other people. It's decided by the people within that group how that space looks like. Consulting, as we've kind of touched on already, moving away from privatization, which we talked about, addressing the issue of burnout. And not kind of, more collaboration, but also, as you mentioned earlier, there's so many people doing similar work. And so it's about collaborating in ways that you're not duplicating work. And I think that could be a really integral way of kind of thinking about burnout and maybe, the resources that we use across the movement, and how we can better use resources. And, like across the board, we need better representation within leadership positions of First Nations, and called people. And when there's not, there needs to be less of a top-down approach and more of an ability for First Nations and called people to have their voices heard, to have their what they're saying represented in projects, programs, all of it. Also, a big one, investing in place-based work and grassroots organizing, because that's where a lot of this work is already happening. So tapping into the work that's already being done, which I really think takes people who have the ability to do this to really have trust that this work is actually happening. It's not just something people are saying is happening. It's really happening, and there's plenty of examples of that and how effective it is. And yeah, as someone had mentioned earlier in the case study, it may not fit the mold of that top-down approach, but it, when you think of it in terms of resourcing, is probably getting us a lot further than what the top-down approach actually is. So yeah, those are some of the main things. How about you?
I really like those. I feel like they really encompass almost like all the pillars of climate work. So that's really cool. I think one thing that I would really recommend to people is a mindset shift, right? So we talked before about how white supremacy culture is, it's all around us. It's the air we breathe. It's the world that we live in. And unless we are choosing every day to go, I need to betray white supremacy. I need to figure out how I'm going to make white supremacy really difficult today. And unless you're considering how, well, unless you're making that active choice to betray it, you will inevitably end up reinforcing it because, again, that's just the culture that we're in. So those are the cultural norms that we do, and we just don't even think about it. So having that in mind, that I'm going to betray white supremacy today and tomorrow and every other day, and that's going to feel uncomfortable sometimes, because sometimes it means speaking up in spaces where you're not expected to. So you might be a white person in a room full of all these other white people, and you're the only one bringing up colonialism, racism, and everyone's kind of looking at you and being like, oh, shut up, buzzkill, ruining things. And of course, you're going to have those voices in your head as well, being like, oh, I'm being really annoying. But I guess I would really urge you and ask you to persevere with that and actually push through that discomfort, because out the other side, what you are creating is solidarity with First People and people of color. And it's also, opening up the minds of others, because inevitably, hopefully, there'll be others in that room who also agree with you. And I think as well, then thinking about, okay, not just what I can do, but how can I put this into systems? So thinking about the things that you have control over. Maybe you're a volunteer at a climate organization. Maybe you are a manager at a climate organization. It doesn't matter, because in both of those circumstances, you can make even tiny changes that do make a difference. For instance, maybe you're a volunteer and your next volunteer meeting is coming up. So maybe you coordinate with everyone to make sure that there's a lovely potluck and you go and sit in a park and have a really wholesome picnic whilst also doing your activist planning and banner painting and stuff. Like the two can go together. And you don't have to spend heaps of money for this stuff. You know, we can all pitch in, we can all bring a bit so that no one's put out. Alternately, though, if you're a manager or you're a senior leader at a climate organization, you can think about how am I going to get donors thinking about colonizing? You know, how am I going to start those conversations with our donors? Maybe you're thinking about leading an audit into white supremacy culture at your organization. So, thinking about where are people of color and first people employed in this organization? Most climate organizations don't employ any first people. How are we making sure that those voices are heard? You know, do we have a First Nations reference group? Do we pay that reference group? Is it an appropriate amount of money that we're paying them? Are we actually listening to them and what they're recommending? Also thinking about, like, do we have people of color and first people in senior leadership on the board in decision-making roles, not just in the accounts department, not just in IT, not just in junior roles? And often it is in junior roles that we will see this phenomenon of the woman of color in a nonprofit, where she tends to go in, is celebrated by the organization. They go, oh yeah, this is fantastic. We are anti-racist, we love this. And then she inevitably starts asking questions and saying, hey, we should change this and we should try that. And then they go, oh no, we don't like this. Defensive, retaliation. Suddenly she's being pushed out of the organization. She's on a performance plan. She leaves and she goes, wow, I'm never doing that again. And tells all of her friends to never go near that. And of course, it was awful. And, you know, it's definitely something that I've experienced. It's pretty much, I can't think of a single person of color in the climate world who hasn't experienced that. Have you
Yeah,
as well?
absolutely, 100%, 100%. Yeah.
Yeah, it's so common. And it's like it's so common and so well documented. You can just look up like the problem woman of color at work and several articles will come up. When things are so well known and documented, isn't it a bit embarrassing if you haven't made any inroads on that? So also just thinking about it as like, okay, what do we need to do?
So I was just going to say one thing about it being
Yeah.
embarrassing too. It's like,
Please.
I think almost like part of doing this work is like we want those things to be embarrassing, and at the moment they're not. That they're thought of as things that people can get away with, and oh, we can, oh, it's okay. And it's like, no, we need to get to a point where we're having conversations about this kind of a thing, and it is embarrassing. It is not okay. Like, to do those things. And right now, I think people think they can get away with it, and that sucks.
Definitely. Like, as a society, we've managed to make it embarrassing, right, to not have any women in senior leadership. And you look at, you know, senior leadership, you go, oh, there's three white men there. But we all know that people are really just talking about the man part and not the race part. And it's
Totally.
like, okay, well, bring that same energy that you bring to like women on boards, bring that to us as well, because it's like, I look at that and I'm like, wow, that's embarrassing for you. Yikes. Like, that's a massive red flag when I see that. And yeah, I think finally as well, just think about impact. Think about the fact that we want to win. If we need, again, if we want to win on climate, we need to demonstrate power. We need to demonstrate that the majority of people are with us. And right now, that's not happening. Right now, the climate movement does not have that power, but we know that it can. It absolutely can. It's absolutely possible. But it means working at the speed of trust with different communities. And I know that, you know, we said earlier we're in the critical decade, and I'm also talking about slowing down. But hey, if you'd slowed down and done this 15 years ago, we wouldn't be in this position. So you've got to do it now because it's got to happen at some point, and we're just going to keep getting closer to 2030. And so I would say, you know, get to work, start having those conversations now, start building that trust now. Instead of going, oh, it's really easy for us to build power in inner city Sydney, go, okay, where do we act? actually need to build power to win and go, okay, what's it going to take to win in those communities? Okay, well, I guess we need to hire people from those communities. And if you're doing that, don't put them on bloody minimum wage contracts. You're hiring them for their lived experience. You're hiring them for their connections, their ability to talk to the community in a way that you cannot. Maybe they can speak the language. Maybe they understand cultural traditions. Maybe they just get how that community operates. Whatever it is, it's a skill that you don't have, and it's a skill that you need to pay for. So also making sure that you're appropriately compensating people, because if it weren't for them, you would not be able to win in that way. And that should be considered just as important as having a master's in something. And I think I'll leave it there and just recommend that people read both of our reports to really get into the depth of the recommendations.
Absolutely. Thanks so much, Neha. That was incredible. So lovely to talk to you.
Yeah, I had a really, really enjoyed the chat.